Yeah, they get some things right. They haven't adopted the brain dread three strikes proposal. Okay, you know, that's like saying somebody didn't shoot himself in the head. Oh, great, brilliant, brilliant. That was a great insight. But what's amazing about the telecom stuff is, you know, so there was a bill introduced, and I can't give the specifics because I don't actually know them. To say what the name of the bill, but there's a bill introduced that was basically a network neutrality bill. The bill then had a series of amendments. The amendments were referred to, one of them was referred to as the AT&T amendment. AT&T, you think, wait, where's AT&T in your country telecoms? That doesn't exist. The AT&T amendment was produced by AT&T lobbyists who came over from the United States to lobby for an amendment that would basically take this network neutrality bill and invert it into being an anti-network neutrality bill. It was an amendment that basically said networks were allowed to discriminate for whatever purpose they want. Now, the idea that the European Parliament wouldn't be ashamed of the fact that they were considering an amendment by an American company to a bill that had regulation space just in Europe was outrageous to me. It's just like, where is your dignity, your self-respect, the idea that the American lobbyists are dictating to you what your telecom policy should be? You know, now fortunately we haven't seen it enacted yet, and maybe there's enough of a movement to resist it. But, you know, network neutrality, I'm a strong supporter of. I've been fighting for it for 10 years in different guises. End-to-end was its original push. You know, getting a German graduate to Stanford, Barbara von Schewick, whose fantastic work on this is going to be very important in the American debate. I'm all for it. But that's a harder question than extending terms in copyright, right? So. Good if you get the harder question right, but if you can't get the easy questions right, I'm not yet optimistic. Finally, as to the model for the flat rate, I think we desperately need experimentation at the national level. I think that we don't yet know enough about what the ideal system is, and Germans experimenting one way, the Brazilians experimenting another way, for a period of time would be exactly the right way to proceed. I think there is, in the end, a worldwide model here that actually mirrors suggestions that have been made in the context of patents. So in the context of patents, people like Jamie Love have and Tim Hubbard have suggested a proposal that says, patents for drugs. They say basically, okay, we say we need patents for drugs to support research. And let's say that 2% of GDP is what's necessary to pay for this research. That's a very high number, but let's just say 2%. So that what they say in the context of patents is a nation can choose to pay for that 2% however they want. So they could write a check to some, you know, research institutions that do fund research for 2%, or they can run a patent system where they charge enormously high prices for their drugs and the high prices fund the 2%. Whatever way they want to do it, the point is they've got to get to the 2%. And what that means is the developing nations could make AIDS drugs available for free and pay for their 2% in different ways. And richer nations like the United States might continue to spend enormous amounts of money for pharmaceutical drugs and pay for the 2% in that way. But the point is it would be a local decision at the national level. I think there's an equivalent possible with copyright. Right? Let's say whatever the percentage, royalty percentage of a GDP is that we think it should be worldwide, you then say to a country like China, okay, just pay for it. You know, you don't have to be smashing down DVD plants in your country or shutting down markets where people who make, you know, $20 a month are paying only 50 cents for a CD that you want to sell for $10 to them, right? Instead of forcing the American model of enforcement on top of you, you can figure out how to protect IP in your country however you want. Just pay the tax. The tax is the equivalent of the 2%. I think that would actually be a solution that respected the diversity and economic development of different countries, but continued to earn the royalties necessary to support the copyright system. What the number is, I've calculated that, but I left the paper at home, so I can't actually tell you.
Okay, there was someone else who already did that for you, wasn't there? A long time ago. Okay, I'll turn to this part of the audience again.
Thanks. So I was curious about your, I mean, this may seem like a lightweight question, but I was curious about your opinion that Twitter will have on an economy, like, for instance, distribution of digital content and people who want to receive donations, for instance. I saw recently that there's a new application based on Twitter called TipJoy that lets people Twitter money to each other. And I was curious what you thought of that.
Okay, Oliver, I saw you. I'll come back to you.
Danke. Well, I've got two short questions instead of one big one. First is, due to the sheer abundance of information on the internet, I understand that maybe writers or authors of works of art are more alert to keep focused on preserving their rights or their control, and can certainly understand that. And I'm not in a position to judge whether this impacts their sales or their prospects of their jobs, although it appears that newspapers are actually hit by this. But I would like to know whether you have actually worked out models of, I don't want to use this term, but models of regulations or regulatory models that artists agree with and have you and that are ready for use, so to speak. That's one thing, and the other...
Just for the record, that's not a short question.
Oh, yes. You're right. In my head, it was shorter somehow. Second one, since you focused on... Well, we got to know the thing is about technology and the machinery that makes this available for us. And in fact, like libraries, which existed without problems where everyone could get the information like you did. We didn't face the problems we are facing now, probably because if we cut it down to simple levels, maybe books were too costly to copy, if it's just about paper form. So do you think it's possible to say that the current situation is more based on the actual medium instead of the art, and that we might need different models depending on the medium of transfer we choose, so that we have one standard for the internet and keep the working ways of the real life media, so to speak. Thanks.
Okay, so first as to Twitter, I don't know if you remember this film, Gandhi. When I saw the film, Gandhi, the thing that was struck me as amazing about the story was the ability of Gandhi to produce hundreds of thousands of protesters to support his protests almost overnight. And that was extraordinary because he had no system of broadcast. He had no system to notify anybody of anything. And what we know about what happened in India is that what they instead had was basically a system of retweeting built into the culture, so that Gandhi would just say, "We're going to have this march to the ocean to, protest the monopoly on salt," and Indians would retweet that, and very quickly, all of India knew about this protest, and then they would all come and march. Now, this is what I think is most interesting about Twitter. Right? You know, many people are just baffled, and I too. Like, what is this about? Like, why is this interesting? But what I think is most interesting about Twitter is that it actually facilitates this kind of bottom-up norm recognition and growth. Right, so I once tweeted about what I think of a fundamental right of a Twitter user is one-click retweeting, right? Because I think the most important thing is the ability to signal this is a great point or a great idea or a great thing to do, and to do that simply. And then, you know, I think it'd be fantastic to begin to study the kind of patterns of retweeting and what exactly happens. And in my own work, you know, I mean, I've obviously run a blog. I have a channel at Blip TV, lessig.blip.tv, that has all my stuff. But Twitter has become the most extraordinary driver of attention to my stuff. So when I say something Like I tweeted about the fact that Warner had issued a takedown notice to one of my videos because they said there was a copyright. It was actually the one with the one you saw here. That was retweeted, and there were 27,000 downloads of that within 3 days. I mean, it's an extraordinary number of. So I think that we don't yet know the potential for Twitter in this space. And I think that if we recognize it as this amazing infrastructure for bottom-up coordination, that's exciting, because there's a lot of places we need to produce that. We need it for arts, because we don't have the old model of, you know, managed art production that will make a successful band or not. Now we've got to actually have people signaling, this is great, that's great, and politics too. So I hadn't heard about this particular example of the Tip Joy, but if we can really implement something like that, that would be fantastic. As to these two short questions, So first let's focus on the library point again. I do think that the reason libraries worked so well in the past was the combination of good law and bad technology. So good law in the sense that, you know, if you pick up a physical book and you read it, you're not triggering copyright law. Right? To read a book is not a fair use of the book, it's a free use of the book. Because to read a book is not to produce a copy. To give a book is not a fair use of the book, it's a free use of the book, because to give a book is not to produce a copy. The architecture of copyright law meant that all sorts of ordinary uses of culture were just outside of the reach of copyright law. And at the same time, the technology of reproducing was so bad that it didn't matter what the law said. You couldn't have done anything with it anyway. You couldn't have produced 1,000 copies of this book cheaply enough to make it interesting for people to get access to it. So those two things together made libraries possible. The law didn't actually regulate what you did with books, and there wasn't enough of a threat for the interest to get the law changed. The equivalent of the digital library has none of those freedoms and has all of those threats. Right? So if I share my digital copy of this book, it triggers copyright law because a copy has been made. And now the question is, what's the license? And this book is licensed under a Creative Commons license, but other books aren't. And on the publisher side, the fear is, once you have this up on the internet, then you can distribute it to anybody, and what's the ability to actually make money off it? So I think it's that change that has produced the dilemma that we face here. Now, the first part of the question was then, do I have models here? Or are there answers? Nobody has the models. Nobody. If anybody tells you they have the models, they're lying to you, right? What we know about how models are developed is that we create platforms, and we let different models compete with each other to figure it out. And what we don't have enough of now is legal platform competition. What we have is pirated examples that are on the fringe. And the work of Matt Mason here is fantastic to sort of talk about how that fringe needs to be brought into the mainstream. And we have a couple companies that have the legal stomach to fight and risk the endless amounts of liability that they face for doing anything creative. So, you know, all of my students basically go to work for YouTube and Google to defend the endless legal claims that are made against those companies because they've set up stuff that uses content differently. So what the law needs to do is to open up the space for different models to compete. And I think music will look different from publishing novels, which will look different from publishing scholarly works, which will look different from movies. We just need to get to a place where we can see how those differences manifest themselves. But we know enough to know different models work differently for these forms of production. So I think in this book I talk about, there's a South African Research Council, the Human Sciences Research Council, that was just a research institution. They had 150 researchers in 12 different programs, and they used to produce books that they would sell. And of course, what typically happened is they had a huge inventory of unsold books. So in 2001, they gave up that model and they started giving away all of their books for free online, full complete download of the book, and then they had an option to buy the book. So you could print on demand the book if you wanted, but you didn't have to, you could get it for free. 4 years later, they found that the sales of books had gone up by 300%. For the obvious reason that if you're talking about a South African publisher of scientific works sitting in Europe or in the United States, you're not likely to spend the $50 necessary to get the book to you. But once you see the book, if it's something interesting that your library needs, you're likely to buy it, and so therefore, actually, they sold more books by making everything available for free. I don't think great novelists would see the same return. You know, I think like even not great novelists, like John Grisham or somebody like that, if they made their books available for free, they'd probably make less money. Right? So the point is, these are different markets, different models, and we just need the chance for these experiments to happen to see which is going to work in different spaces.